listeners, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who is very excited to bring you the results of the 2012 Audi Awards. The Audis recognize distinction in audiobooks and spoken word entertainment. They're sponsored by the Audio Publishers Association, and they're a very big deal. Yep, they're the Oscars for those of us who love audiobooks. I'm proud to say we featured many of the winners on previous shows. As we go down the list, I'll let you know where, on bookreportradio.com, you can take a listen to those we've already previewed. But I can't wait. The audiobook of the year, drumroll please, is Bossy Pants by Tina Fey, which we previewed on May 13, 2011. The title also garnered the award for Best Biography Memoir. Great stuff. Let's start listening to more of this year's award winners as we turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
In prime time, love, health, sex, fitness, friendship, spirit, making the most of all of your life, Jane Fonda gives us a blueprint for living well and for making the most of life, especially the second half of it. Highlighting new research and stories from her own life and those of others, Fonda explores how the critical years from 45 and 50, and especially 60s and beyond, can be times when we truly become the energetic, fulfilled people we were meant to be. Fonda, this Audi Award winner, covers the 11 key ingredients for vital living, and she invites you to consider how to live a more insightful, healthy, and fully integrated life. In her research, Fonda discovered two metaphors, the arch and the staircase, that became two visions of life for her. She shows you how to see your life as the staircase, as one of continual ascent. Since average life expectancy has jumped, Fonda, who performs the book, asks, what are we meant to do with this precious gift of time?
We, today's boomers and seniors, are the pioneer generations, the ones who need to compose together a template for how to maximize the potential of this amazing gift of time, so as to become whole, fully realized people over the longer life arc. In attempting to chart a course for myself into my 60s and beyond, I found it helpful to view the symphony of my own life in three acts, or three major developmental stages. Act 1, the first three decades, Act 2, the middle three decades, and Act 3, the final three decades, or however many more years one is granted. As I search for ways to understand the new realities of aging, I discovered the arch and the staircase. The arch and the staircase. These two shapes depict opposing metaphors for two conceptions of human life that have come to mean a lot to me. One shape, the arch, represents a biological concept taking us from childhood to a middle peak of maturity followed by a decline into infirmity. The other, a staircase, shows our potential for upward progression toward wisdom, spiritual growth, learning. Towards, in other words, consciousness and soul. The vision behind these concepts was developed by Rudolf Arnheim, the late professor emeritus of the psychology of art at Harvard University. And for me, they are clear metaphors for ways we can choose to view aging. Our youth-obsessed culture encourages us to focus on the arch, age as physical decline, more than on the stairway, age as potential for continued development and ascent. But it is the staircase that points to late life's promise, even in the face of physical decline. Perhaps it should be a spiral staircase, because the wisdom, balance, reflection, and compassion that this upward movement represents don't just come to us in one linear ascension. They circle around us, beckoning us to keep climbing, to keep looking, both back and ahead. Rehearsing the future. Throughout my life, whenever I was confronted by something I feared, I tried to make it my best friend, stare it in the face, and get to know its ins and outs. Eleanor Roosevelt once said, quote, "You gain strength, courage, and confidence by every experience in which you really stop to look fear in the face," unquote. I have found this to be true. This is how I discovered that knowledge about what lies ahead can empower me, help me conquer my fears, take the wind out of the sails of my anxiety. Know thine enemy. Remember Rumpelstiltskin, the evil dwarf in the Grimm's fairy tale? He was destroyed once the miller's daughter learned his name and called it out. When we name our fears, bring them out into the open and examine them in the light, they weaken and wither. So, one of the ways I've tried to overcome my fears of aging involved rehearsing for it. In fact, I started doing this in Act Two. I believe that this rehearsal for the future, along with doing a life review of the past, is part of why I have been able, so far, to live Act Three with relative equanimity. Being with my father when he was in his late 70s and in decline due to heart problems was what began to shatter any childhood illusions I had of immortality. I was in my mid-40s, and it hit me that with him gone, I would be the oldest one left in the family, and before too long, next at the turnstile. I realized then that it was not so much the idea of death itself that frightened me, as it was being faced with regrets, the what-ifs and if-onlys, when there's no time left to do anything about them. I didn't want to arrive at the end of the third act and discover too late all that I had not done.
We've just heard Primetime by Jane Fonda. And now, let's hear from Robin Witten on our monthly check-in with the editor of Audiophile magazine. Welcome, Robin. Thanks so much for checking back in with us today.
Well, great to be here again, Elaine.
So, you attended the recent Audi Awards. Tell us about that.
I did. It was a spectacular evening, a very glittery event at the New York Historical Society. And it was full of lots of elegantly attired actors and publishers. And in the beginning, we had a wonderful reception where everyone was a little nervous because most of them were nominees and wearing their medals and things, hoping for the best outcome for the Audie's Award.
So I know that Tina Fey won Best Book of the Year. Were you surprised about that recognition?
Oh, I wasn't at all. In fact, it was a fantastic book. It was well worth it being the audiobook of the year. And also, you know, it won in the biography and memoir category because it really was fantastic, entertaining on so many levels. And, you know, she's a fantastic performer, and she certainly did that memoir in a way that really connected with a lot of people.
How many years has the Audi Awards been happening?
I believe that this was the 17th Audi Award.
Okay, so were there any big upsets in the night?
Well, you know, one of the things that I, as much as I loved Bossy Pants and the Tina Fey and thought that she absolutely should have won, in the same category, Neil Gaiman's American Gods was also nominated for Audiobook of the Year, and that was a particular favorite of mine this year, beautifully, beautifully produced with many voices. And Neil Gaiman was at the Audi Awards Gala. So he was a presenter and very gracious and a wonderful, but he didn't win. That was sad.
Was Tina Fey actually there?
And Tina Fey was not there. So, you know, maybe they should have it so whoever shows up is actually has to pick up the award. I don't know.
I know.
That would have been fun.
Yeah, there's quite a few Saturday Night Live alumni who came out with books this year. I know Rachel Dratch came out with one, and we actually previewed that, and that one was a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, well, you know, they're pretty great communicators, so that, you know, that's always makes a good presentation. But you know, there were some interesting lots of the narrators were at the awards. Simon Vance, who won in the Best Male Narrator category, and that he was there. That was great. Roslyn Landor, who won Best Female Narrator for The Winter Sea, was also there. Let's see, shall I go on with others of the actors that people might know?
Sure.
Well, as I said, Adriana Trigiani, who was the host last year, who's a wonderful presenter and had one was nominated for her most recent book. Jonathan Davis won in history. Susan Erickson actually won in two categories for romance, with a J.D. Robb title, and also in the thriller category. And I think that may be the first time that she's won an Audi, so that was pretty exciting. She was there. Catherine Kellgren, who's had many nominations, won in the teen category for the latest in the Bloody Jack series, the Lorelei Lee, and that was always nice to see her.
Right. Let me ask you. I know that the magazine has complete sort of lineup of who the winners were. How can listeners get that list?
It is very easily found at theaudies.com. That's presented by Audiophile Magazine, and we have the winners, all the finalists, sound clips for each of the titles, and also the Audiophile reviews.
Robin, before we say goodbye, I wanted to let listeners know again about this wonderful program called Audio Sync that you have.
Yes, Audiobook Sync is the website, audiobooksync.com, where listeners can find out about a program for free audiobooks for teens and young adult listening for the summer. And each week for the next 8 weeks, we give away two complete free audiobooks as downloads through this audiobooksync.com program.
Okay, and that's audio S-Y-N-C, correct?
S-Y-N-C.
Okay.
And it's all for teens and YA listening.
All right, well, that's important information. Thanks, Robin. We'll talk more about that next month.
Okay.
All righty. Bye.
Bye.
Think you have what it takes to run a business? Carrie Wilkerson, Audi Award winner for business, offers the opportunity to live life on your terms in The Barefoot Executive, The Ultimate Guide to Being Your Own Boss and Achieving Financial Freedom. Want to start your workday with email and coffee on the back patio? Want the flexibility of joining your fourth grader on an all-day field trip? Then you have a choice to make, and The Barefoot Executive, narrated by the author, helps you jumpstart your transition. You'll learn what type of business best suits your experience and talents, how to stay focused on your goal, and where to find the support you need. Whether it's a service, a product, or your expertise, you already have the raw materials to transform your life. Carrie's guidance is practical. No philosophical hoo-ha here, no theoretical abstractions, just concrete action steps along insights from fellow entrepreneurs.
On these pages, you won't read how I've been a business owner since birth or sold Beanie Babies on eBay, predicting my entrepreneurial destiny. I have never operated a lemonade stand. I did not have a paper route. I wasn't required to help my parents put food on the table. And honestly, I never gave going into business for myself a second thought. After getting a high school education, attending college to study music, which I abandoned for marriage, choosing to finish a degree that took fewer hours and less time away from my beloved, I was still set on a course of traditional employment. More specifically, I was employed in a government-run educational institution, also known as a public school. Yes, I was a teacher, and I loved it, and I thought I would be teaching for a long while. But then I became a mom. The story leading up to it perhaps isn't so important to you, but the end result is that I was a mother of toddler siblings, and my priorities shifted more quickly than the ink on the adoption papers dried. I was a mother. My kids needed me, and for various reasons, I wasn't going to leave them in the care of someone else if I could figure out how to avoid it. However, I had no financial plan. I had no savings account. We relied on my salary, as my husband was still climbing the corporate ladder. But it was what it was, and we had 6 weeks left of a teacher's summer paycheck to figure something out. That was in 1998, and I have since rendered myself and my husband unemployable. We cannot and will not consider working on a schedule, on a time clock, or on a payroll for anyone else. We now have 4 children and live a life of financial independence and what I would consider full security, meaning we are dependent only on our ability to serve our clients and offer value to the marketplace. This is what I want for you too. I don't have a business degree. I've never taken a certified business class or been credentialized in any formal way. My advice is from real application, practical techniques, and solid experience. From babysitting and bagging groceries for tips to being a barefoot CEO, we really are in a time when we can create our own realities. No longer do we rely on a standard track of education, then apply for a job, stay until we retire, and pray for security and good benefits along the way. We really are in a position to create our own careers, our own paths, and our own incomes if we dare. My goal is to give you hope and to take you through the process of investigating your options and your skill sets to create the financial freedom and work life that you've perhaps only dreamed of until now. Ignore the naysayers and avoid the status quo.
That was a sampling of The Barefoot Executive by Carrie Wilson. Men, women, and children were on board the Titanic when tragedy struck. Alan Wolfe's The Watch That Ends the Night, Voices from the Titanic, captures 24 of these haunting voices. This wholly unique recreation of the Titanic disaster, which has just earned the Audi for Distinguished Achievement in Production, spans classes and stations, from Margaret Brown, the unsinkable Molly, to Captain E.J. Smith, who went down with his ship, from the lookout and wireless men to a gambler in search of fools with money to lose. Slipping in telegraphs, undertaker reports, and other records, the book, performed by an ensemble cast, offers a breathtaking, intimate glimpse into the lives of 24 passengers and crew.
The millionaire thinks Titanic is a ship of pleasure. The emigrant thinks Titanic is a ship of dreams. But they are both wrong. For Titanic is not a ship at all. Titanic is just good business. Very good business. E.J. Smith, the captain. Whenever two words will do, Mr. Ismay is certain to use 10. I'm not necessarily a man of few words, but to sum up Titanic, I need just one. Big. Ismay speaks of Titanic's luxury. Her elegant lines like a yacht for the gods, her lush appointments, her state-of-the-art mechanics, her ingenious safety features. Ismay and White Star cut no costs to build her, I assure you of that. But in matters of handling, she is mostly just big. And my plan is to pilot her as I would any other big ship. I will go as fast as I can and as straight as I can, from one point to the next until we see New York Harbor. Thomas Andrews, the shipbuilder. It seemed like a dream. The name Thomas Andrews forever associated with Titanic. Even as a young boy, I loved ships. Lucky for me, my Uncle William, the great Lord Pirrie, was chairman of Harland and Wolff. Naturally, I visited the shipyard often, and eventually I found work there. But not as some high-ranking executive. Uncle would not have that. No. At 16, I began the 5-year apprenticeship that would seal my fate. It meant spending less time tending my bees. But with the admittance into this shipbuilder's hive, everything else was of secondary importance. No job was too small or menial that I did not work at it for weeks, or months if necessary. Heater boy, riveter, catcher, holder-upper, and carpenter. I learned from the joiners and cabinet makers, the shipwrights, the painters, the fitters, and smiths. Below decks, I watched the workings of the stoker, the greaser, the trimmer. Above, I watched the workings of the baker, the waiter, the steward. My longest training came in the drafting department, learning machine and freehand drawing, applied mechanics, and the theories of naval architecture. I adopted and improved upon my uncle's designs. And eventually the Titanic project was given to me. I feel as though I built her with my own two hands, and like her loyal minion, I will tend to her needs, no matter the cost, whatever the tide.
The iceberg. I am the ice. I see tides ebb and flow. I've watched civilizations come and go, give birth, destroy, restore, be gone, begin. My blink of an eye is humankind's tortoise slow. Today's now is tomorrow's way back when. Bright Arctic night gives way to cold black morn. Tall masts and canvas sails give way to steam. One iceberg melts away, another's born. I am the sum of all that I have seen. I am the ice. I know the ebb and flow. 10,000 years ago I fell as snow, and as I fell, my bulk began to grow. And as I grew, I watched as worlds arose. The caveman's spear, the woolly mammoth tusk, arose and clashed and then returned to dust. I am the ice. I've seen the ebb and flow. I watched as Abraham and Moses spoke. I watched the prophets met with wine or stone. I watched as Christ was nailed upon the cross. I watched Mohammed forced to flee his home. I've watched the holy battle to and fro. I am the ice. I've seen the ebb and flow. Conceived by water, temperature, and time, gestating within Greenland's glacial womb, I carved out massive valleys as I moved.
That was The Watch That Ends the Night by Alan Wolfe.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Of the Audie for History, 1861, The Civil War Awakening, presents a gripping and original account of how the Civil War began. It is a rich tableau of America on the cusp of war. Author Adam Goodhart introduces us to a heretofore little-known cast of Civil War heroes. Among them, an explorer's wife, an idealistic band of German immigrants, a regiment of New York City firemen, a community of Virginia slaves, and a young college professor who would one day become president. From the corridors of the White House to the slums of Manhattan, from the mouth of the Chesapeake to the deserts of Nevada, the book, performed by Jonathan Davis, vividly evokes the Union at this moment of ultimate crisis.
In the early afternoon of May 9th, a handsome barouche with a black coachman in the driver's seat pulled up to the front gate of Camp Jackson. Inside it rode a genteel old lady dressed in a shawl, a heavy veil, and an enormous sunbonnet. In her lap she held a small wicker basket. The sentries waved her through. Clearly this was just a widow paying a visit to her militiaman son. The basket must be full of sandwiches she had lovingly prepared for her dear boy. In fact, the wicker basket held two loaded Colt revolvers. And if the sentries had peered under the old lady's veil, they would have glimpsed something even more surprising. A bushy red beard. Surely there must have been 100 simpler ways to reconnoiter the rebels' picnic ground. Nathaniel Lyon, however, was not one to pass up an opportunity for intrigue, and apparently thought his escapade would seem picturesque rather than ridiculous. He had borrowed the dress, shawl, veil, and sunbonnet from Frank Blair's mother-in-law. Anyhow, his leisurely drive through Camp Jackson showed him exactly what he wanted to see: the mysterious crates from the steamer, still unopened. Early the next morning, a horseman was seen galloping southward down Carondelet Road on his way to the U.S. troops' outlying encampments. By midday, columns of soldiers were marching through the streets of the city, converging on Camp Jackson. Bornstein, in a splendid plumed alpine hat, rode astride a horse at the head of his regiment. Herr Oberst Siegel, on the other hand, rolled along in carriage behind his men. The first casualty of the day, he had fallen off his horse onto the cobblestones and hurt his leg. Tony Niederwieser, the saloon keeper, strutted at the head of a company. For weeks, the city's German press had throbbed with ever-purpler prose. The North has awakened from its slumber. The earth shakes under the tread of its legions, and the South trembles, exulted the Westliche Post. Suddenly, a new race arises like a phoenix from the general conflagration, and our workaday politicians sink into the oblivion they deserve. The great goal of mankind, the demand for freedom, will rise ever more glorious and flow like gold in the heat from the fire of battle. 2 days before the advance on Camp Jackson, the editors had hailed the uprising of the people in the northern states. That is, the tremendous surge of patriotic feeling and military enlistment after Sumter, as one of the greatest events in world history since the defeat of Napoleon. This period will be called the Second American Revolution, they predicted. It will be able to turn the great principles enunciated in the First Revolution into reality. And, thanks to the quick dissemination of news by steamboat and telegraph, this revolution would also spread across the Atlantic, so that soon the cry of jubilation of the liberated nations of Europe will echo across the ocean, greeting us as saviors and brothers. Yet, the German volunteers themselves, after all their excitement during the previous months, seemed strangely subdued on the morning of the attack. As they marched through the streets of St. Louis, no one sang, no bands played. Dressed in their civilian clothes, they seemed to trudge like cattle, one observer said. Perhaps, like Isidore Busch, himself now a private in one of the Home Guard regiments, too many had already seen firsthand the unpredictable calamities of war. Ulysses Grant stood across from the arsenal's main gate, in front of the Anheuser-Busch Brewery, watching the troops file out. Still eager to make acquaintances that might lead to a commission, he took the opportunity to introduce himself to Blair, who was on horseback marshaling the companies, and wish him luck. William T. Sherman, on his way to the streetcar company office, heard people on every corner saying excitedly that the Dutch were moving on Camp Jackson. The streets were filling with people hurrying after the troops, swept along almost involuntarily, anxious spectators of every political proclivity, one witness wrote, never doubting for a moment that if a fight should occur, they could stand by unharmed and witness it all. One big bearded man, distraught at Lyon's surprise attack, shouted, he's gone out to kill all the boys! To kill all the boys! Although a couple of Sherman's friends urged him to come and see the fun, he hurried in the opposite direction, walking quickly home to make sure his 7-year-old son, Willie, had not joined the packs of schoolboys scampering toward the excitement.
We've just heard 1861 by Adam Goodhart. Fuzzy Nation, John Scalzi's reimagining of H. Beam Piper's 1962 sci-fi classic Little Fuzzy, has just been awarded the Audi for Science Fiction. Written with the full cooperation of the Piper estate, the story unfolds on the distant planet Zarathustra. There, Jack Holloway is content as an independent contractor for Zaracorp, as a prospector and surveyor. In the wake of an accidental cliff collapse, Jack discovers a seam of unimaginably valuable jewels. He manages to lay claim to them, just as Zaracorp is canceling their contract with him for his part in the collapse. But there are, of course, wrinkles. When a small furry biped, trusting, appealing, and ridiculously cute, shows up at Jack's home, it dawns upon him that despite their stature, these fuzzies might be hopelessly endangered by Zaracorp, who view them as obstacles to their claim of the planet's wealth. Will Wheaton and John Scalzi narrate.
Jack Holloway set the skimmer to hover, swiveled his seat around, and looked at Carl. He shook his head, sadly. I can't believe we have to go through this again, Holloway said. It's not that I don't value you as part of this team, Carl. I do. Really, I do. But I can't help but think that, in some way, I'm just not getting through to you. We've gone over this how many times now? A dozen? Two? And yet every time we come out here, it's like you forget everything you've been taught. It's really very discouraging. Tell me you get what I'm saying to you. Carl stared up at Holloway and barked. He was a dog. Fine, Holloway said. Maybe this time it will stick. He reached down into a storage bin and hoisted a mound of putty in one hand. This is acoustical blasting putty. What do we do with it? Carl cocked his head. Come on, Carl, Holloway said. This is the first thing I taught you. We put it on the side of the cliff at strategic points, Holloway said, just like I already did earlier today. You remember, you were there. He pointed in the direction of Carl's cliff, a massive outcropping of rock 200 meters high, with geological striations peeking out of the vegetation covering most of the rock face. Carl followed Holloway's finger with his eyes, more interested in the finger than in the cliff his master had named for him. Holloway set down the putty and picked up another, smaller object. And this is the remote-controlled blasting cap, he said, which we attach to the acoustical blasting putty so we don't have to be near the acoustical blasting putty when we set it off, because that's boom. How do we feel about boom, Carl? Carl got a concerned look on his doggy face. Boom was a word he knew. Carl was not fond of Boom. Right, Holloway said. He set down the blasting cap, making sure it was nowhere near the blasting putty and that the cap receiver was inactive. He picked up a third object. And this is the remote detonator, Holloway said. You remember this, right, Carl? Carl barked. What's that, Carl? Holloway said. You want to set off the acoustical blasting putty? Carl barked again. I don't know, Holloway said doubtfully. Technically, it is a violation of Zarathustra Corporation's safe labor practices to allow a non-sentient species member to set off high explosives. Carl came up to Holloway and licked his face with a whine that said, please, please, oh, please. Oh, all right, Holloway said, fending off the dog. But this is the last time, at least until you grasp all the fundamentals of the job. No more slacking off and leaving all the hard work to me. I'm paid to supervise. Are we clear? Carl barked once more and then backed off, tail wagging. He knew what was coming next. Holloway glanced down at the detonator's image panel and checked for the third time since he placed the charges earlier in the day that the detonator was keyed specifically to the blasting caps placed into the charges. He pressed the panel to answer yes to each of the automated safety questions and waited while the detonator confirmed by geolocation that it was, in fact, safely outside the blast radius of any charges. This could be overridden, but it took some hacking, and anyway, Holloway preferred not to blow himself up whenever possible. And Carl was not so fond of Boom. Charges set and ready, read the detonator panel. Press panel to detonate. Okay, Holloway said, and set the detonator on the skimmer floor between him and Carl. Carl looked up expectantly. Wait for it, Holloway said, and swiveled around in his chair to face the cliff. He could hear Carl's tail thumping excitedly against a crate. Wait for it, Holloway said again, and tried to spy the places on the cliff he had drilled into earlier in the day, using the skimmer as a platform while he inserted and secured the charges into the drill holes. Carl gave a little whine. Fire! Holloway said, and heard the dogs scramble forward. The cliff puffed out in four spots, spewing rock and dirt and hurling vegetation for meters. The cliff face darkened as the birds, which is to say the local flying animal equivalent to birds, that had been nesting in the cliff face's vegetation, took to the air, alarmed by the noise and sudden eruptions. A few seconds later, four closely spaced cracks snapped the air in the skimmer's open cockpit, the sound of the explosions finally reaching Holloway and Carl. Loud, but without the Carl worrying boom. Holloway glanced over to his right, where his information panel lay, sonic imaging program up and running. The sonic probes he'd placed on and around the cliff were spewing their raw feed into the program, which was collating and combining the data, turning it into a three-dimensional representation of the internal structure of the cliff. All right, he said, and swiveled around to look at Carl, who still had his paw on the detonator, tongue lolling out of his mouth. Good boy, Holloway said, and dug into the storage bin to pull out a Zeraraptor bone, still heavy with meat. He unwrapped it from its storage film and tossed it at Carl, who fell on it happily. That was the deal. Press the detonator, get a bone. It had taken Holloway more than a few tries to get Carl to press the detonator accurately, but it had been worth the effort. Carl had to come on the surveying trips anyway. Might as well have him be useful, or at least entertaining.
That was Fuzzy Nation by John Scalzi.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz.
We're there when you can't be.
Classics are always a favorite of the Book Report, whether to rediscover or explore anew. The Life and Adventures of Nicholas Nickleby by Charles Dickens, performed here by Simon Vance, has just won the Audie in the Classics category. And, to digress for a moment, Simon Vance, who's been a guest on the show, has also just been awarded the prestigious 2012 Audie for Solo Narration for his performance of The King's Speech. Back to Dickens, the likable young Nicholas, left penniless on the death of his father, sets off in search of better prospects. His meandering route to happiness includes work in a variety of odd jobs that allow Dickens the freedom to follow the eccentricities of a vivid gallery of characters. This is an exploration of themes of class, love, and self-awareness.
With a portion of this property, Mr. Godfrey Nickleby purchased a small farm near Dawlish in Devonshire, whither he retired with his wife and two children to live upon the best interest he could get for the rest of his money, and the little produce he could raise from his land. The two prospered so well together that, when he died, some 15 years after this period, and some 5 after his wife, he was enabled to leave to his eldest son, Ralph, £3,000 in cash, and to his youngest son, Nicholas, 1,000 and the farm, which was as small a landed estate as one would desire to see. These two brothers had been brought up together in a school at Exeter, and, being accustomed to go home once a week, had often heard from their mother's lips long accounts of their father's sufferings in his days of poverty, and of their deceased uncle's importance in his days of affluence, which recitals produced a very different impression on the two. For while the younger, who was of a timid and retiring disposition, gleaned from thence nothing but forewarnings to shun the great world and attach himself to the quiet routine of a country life, Ralph, the elder, deduced from the often repeated tale the two great morals that riches are the only true source of happiness and power, and that it is lawful and just to compass their acquisition by all means short of felony. "And," reasoned Ralph with himself, "if no good came of my uncle's money when he was alive, a great deal of good came of it after he was dead, inasmuch as my father has got it now, and is saving it up for me, which is a highly virtuous purpose. And, going back to the old gentleman, good did come of it to him too, for he had the pleasure of thinking of it all his life long, and of being envied and courted by all his family besides." And Ralph always wound up these mental soliloquies by arriving at the conclusion that there was nothing like money. Not confining himself to theory or permitting his faculties to rust even at that early age in mere abstract speculations, this promising lad commenced usurer on a limited scale at school, putting out at good interest a small capital of slate, pencil, and marbles, and gradually extending his operations until they aspired to the copper coinage of this realm, in which he speculated to considerable advantage. Nor did he trouble his borrowers with abstract calculations of figures or references to ready reckoners, his simple rule of interest being all comprised in the one golden sentence, 2 pence for every halfpenny, which greatly simplified the accounts, and which, as a familiar precept, more easily acquired and retained in the memory than any known rule of arithmetic, cannot be too strongly recommended to the notice of capitalists, both large and small, and more especially of money brokers and bill discounters. Indeed, to do these gentlemen justice, many of them are to this day in the frequent habit of adopting it, with eminent success. In like manner did young Ralph Nickleby avoid all those minute and intricate calculations of odd days, which nobody who has worked sums in simple interest can fail to have found most embarrassing, by establishing the one general rule that all sums of principal and interest should be paid on pocket money day, that is to say, on Saturday, and that whether a loan were contracted on the Monday or on the Friday, the amount of interest should be, in both cases, the same. Indeed, he argued, and with great show of reason, that it ought to be rather more for one day than for 5, inasmuch as the borrower might in the former case be very fairly presumed to be in great extremity, otherwise he would not borrow at all with such odds against him. This fact is interesting, as illustrating the secret connection and sympathy which always exists between great minds. Though Master Ralph Nickleby was not at that time aware of it, the class of gentlemen before alluded to proceed on just the same principle in all their transactions. From what we have said of this young gentleman, and the natural admiration the reader will immediately conceive of his character, it may perhaps be inferred that he is to be the hero of the work which we shall presently begin. To set this point at rest, for once and forever, we hasten to undeceive them, and stride to its commencement.
That was the life and adventures of Nicholas Nickleby. Rosalind Candor has been awarded the 2012 Audi for her solo narration work in The Winter Sea. The book, by Susanna Kearsley, follows the story of historical fiction novelist Carrie McClelland. Carrie rents a summer cottage on the coast of Scotland, near to Slane Castle, where the Jacobite uprising occurred centuries ago. As the story unfolds, two narratives appear: Carrie writing her novel in present-day Scotland, and then, as her writing progresses, she begins to wonder if she might be dealing with ancestral memory, making her the only living person who knows the truth of the ultimate betrayal of 1708.
My father always told me that the sea was in my blood. I had been born and raised beside it on the shores of Nova Scotia, and I never could resist its siren pull. So when the main road out of Aberdeen turned inland, I turned right instead, and took the way along the coast. I couldn't say how far away I was when I first saw the ruined castle on the cliffs, a line of jagged darkness set against a cloud-filled sky. But from the moment I first saw it, I was captivated, driving slightly faster in the hope I'd reach it sooner, paying no attention to the clustered houses I was driving past, and feeling disappointment when the road curved sharply off again, away from it. But then, beyond the tangle of a wood, the road curved back again, and there it was, a long, dark ruin, sharp against the snowbound fields that stretched forbiddingly between the cliff's edge and the road. I saw a parking lot ahead, a little level place with logs to mark the spaces for the cars, and on an impulse, I pulled in and stopped. The lot was empty. Not surprising, since it wasn't even noon yet, and the day was cold and windy, and there wasn't any reason anyone would stop out here unless they wanted to walk out to see the ruin. And from looking at the only path that I could see that led to it, a frozen farm lane drifted deep with snow that would have risen past my knees, I guessed there wouldn't be too many people stopping here today. I knew I shouldn't stop myself. There wasn't time. I had to be in Peterhead by 1 o'clock. But something in me felt a sudden need to know exactly where I was, and so I reached to check my map. I'd spent the past 5 months in France. I'd bought my map there, and it had its limitations, being more concerned with roads and highways than with towns and ruins. I was looking so hard at the squiggle of coastline and trying to make out the names in fine print that I didn't see the man till he'd gone past me, walking slowly, hands in pockets, with a muddy-footed spaniel at his heels. It seemed a strange place for a man on foot to be, out here. The road was busy, and the snow along the banks left little room to walk beside it, but I didn't question his appearance. Any time I had a choice between a living, breathing person and a map, I chose the person. So I scrambled, map in hand, and got my car door open. But the salt wind blowing off the sea across the fields was stronger than I'd thought it would be. It stole my voice. I had to try again. "Excuse me?" I believe the spaniel heard me first. It turned, and then the man turned too, and seeing me, retraced his steps. He was a younger man than I'd expected, not much older than myself, mid-30s maybe, with dark hair whipped roughly by the wind, and a close-trimmed dark beard that made him look a little like a pirate. His walk, too, had a swagger to it, confident. He asked me,
"Can I help you?"
"Can you show me where I am?" I held the map towards him. Coming round to block the wind, he stood beside me, head bent to the printed coastline.
"Here,"
he said, and pointed to a nameless headland. Cruden Bay. Where are you meant to be?
His head turned very slightly as he asked that, and I saw his eyes were not a pirate's eyes. They were clear grey and friendly, and his voice was friendly too, with all the pleasant, rolling cadence of the northern Scot. I said, I'm going north to Peterhead.
Well, that's not a problem.
He pointed it out on the map.
It's not far. You just keep on this road. It'll take you right up into Peterhead.
Close by his knee, the dog yawned a complaint, and he sighed and looked down.
Half a minute. You see that I'm talking?
I smiled. What's his name?
Angus.
Bending, I scratched the dog's hanging ears, spattered with mud. Hello, Angus. You've been for a run.
Aye, he's run all the day if I'd let him. He's not one for standing still.
Neither, I thought, was his master. The man had an aura of energy, restlessness, and I'd delayed him enough.
Then I'll let you get going, I said as I straightened. Thank you for your help.
Nay bother,
he assured me, and he turned and started off again, the spaniel trotting happily ahead. The hardened footpath stretched ahead of them, towards the sea, and at its end I saw the castle ruin, standing stark and square and roofless to the swiftly running clouds, and as I looked at it, I felt a sudden pulling urge to stay, to leave the car parked where it was, and follow man and dog where they had gone, and hear the roaring of the sea around those crumbled walls. But I had promises to keep. So, with reluctance, I got back into my rental car, turned the key, and started off again towards the north.
That was The Winter Sea by Susanna Kearsley.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
In New York to Dallas in Death by J.D. Robb, we meet Eve Dallas, a cop, now being threatened by one of her earliest takedowns. A monster named Isaac McQueen had been abducting young victims and leaving them scarred in mind and body. Thanks to Eve, he wound up where he belonged, in Rikers. But he's not behind bars anymore. After his escape, McQueen has two things in mind. One is to take up where he left off, preying on the young and innocent. Second is to get revenge on the woman who stopped him all those years ago. McQueen sets off on the chase, forcing Eve down a road marked with blood and tears, a road that eventually leads to Dallas, Texas, and the home Eve fled long ago. And each new twist brings her closer to the memory of when she wasn't a hardened detective, but a vulnerable girl, just like McQueen's innocent prey. Once you hear the preview, it's easy to see why this was selected as the Audi 2012 Romance winner. Suzanne Erickson narrates.
She hacked her way through the expense reports, submitted them up the chain. Someone else's problem now, she decided, and felt almost righteous. No reason she couldn't start the evals later. Task complete. Shut it down. Unable to comply, the computer responded. I finished. Inaccurate statement. Previous command stipulated all listed reports and evaluations must be complete before system rest. This command by Dallas Lieutenant Eve, priority basis, can only be countermanded at her order by fire, terrorist attack, alien invasion, or an open and active case requiring her attention. Jesus, had she really programmed that? I change my mind. Previous command specifies changes of mind, fatigue, boredom, and other lame excuses not acceptable for countermand. Bite me, Eve muttered. Unable to comply. Fine, 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 computer. Display previous evals in alpha order for all officers under my command. She worked her way through. She'd put the damn command in to keep herself in line. And because every single one of her men deserved the time and attention it took for a solid and judicious evaluation. She finished Baxter, both Carmichaels, and had slogged her way to Jenkinson when the knock sounded on her door. "Yeah, what?" She scowled over at Peabody as her partner opened the door. "Is it an alien invasion?" "Not that I've heard. There's a guy out here, pretty shaky, claims he can only speak to you. He says it's a matter of life and death." "Yeah?" She perked up. "Computer, life and death countermand. Save and hold."
"Verification required."
"Peabody, tell this machine there's a human being requiring my attention on a matter of life and death." "Computer, Peabody, Detective Delia, request the lieutenant's attention on an urgent matter."
"Verification accepted. Saving data. On hold."
Annoyed, Eve gave the computer a rap with the heel of her hand. It's pretty pitiful when your own comp won't take your word. You put all that in there so you wouldn't squirm out of the paperwork. Still, send life and death back. He came at a stumbling run, a skinny guy she judged as late 20s. He sported a tangle of messy dreads, baggy red shorts, gel flips, a silver lip ring, and a dingy white tank that showed off his tattoo sleeves. Sweat ran down his thin white face. "You're Dallas, Lieutenant Eve Dallas, NYPSD, homicide?" "That's right. What's the..." He burst into tears. Loud, hiccuping tears.
He said, "I could only talk to you. Had to come to you. He's got her. He's got Julie. He's gonna kill her if you don't come back with me. He said an hour, and it took me half that to get here."
His words rolled on top of each other between sobs and shakes. Eve got out of her chair, shoved him into it. "Suck it up and slow down. What's your name?"
"I'm Trey. Trey Schuster."
"Who is he?"
"I don't know. He was just there, in my place, our place. She just moved in last week. Just there when we woke up, and he tied us up. He ate breakfast, and he..." "Doesn't matter. You have to come, or he'll kill her. I forgot I'm supposed to say, there's the bell for round two. Please, he's got a knife. He's gonna cut her. If you don't come, if I got to anybody else, he said he'd kill her."
"Where?"
"My place. Our place, I mean."
"Where's your place, Trey?"
258 Murray Street.
The address clicked, and with the click came a twist in the guts.
We've just heard New York to Dallas in Death by J.D. Robb. Readers, thanks so much for joining me today. It's my job and my pleasure to bring you great books worthy of your time. These Audi Award winners truly are the cream of the crop, and the fact that we've previewed so many of these titles validates my long hours of research each week. I love books, and I love bringing you the best of the best. Please join me next week for the next edition of the Book Report.